From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week around our region. And today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Rachel Cohen, South Central Idaho reporter for Boise State Public Radio, and Sydney Kidd, reporter with Boise Dev. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
Okay, so Clark, let's start with you and let's talk about the Open Primaries Initiative. First, for folks who need to be familiarized with the issue, can you do that? Like what it is, et cetera. And then tell us about how the signature collecting is going because they're trying to get this issue on the ballot.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do my best, Jim. I know there's going to be a lot of interest in this. But yeah, last weekend, I went out with the groups that are gathering signatures for the Open Primary Initiative. What they're attempting to do is get a ballot initiative on the November 2024 general election for Idahoans to vote on to decide whether or not to adopt it. And what the initiative would do, it would make changes to both our primary election and our general election. The first thing they want to do is they want to get rid of the so-called closed primary elections that we have in Idaho. And what that means is that if voters are not affiliated with a political party, that political party doesn't have to let them vote in their primary elections. And we see that with the Republican Party, as well as the Constitution Party and the Libertarian Party. The Democratic Party has actually opened their primary up to others, but the law we have in place allows political parties to close those primaries. And so what they're saying is only a very, very small percentage of Idaho voters actually participate in these closed Republican primaries that are often the most important election in Idaho because of the supermajority factor. So the first thing, if successful, that this ballot initiative would do, It would end the closed primary, and it would replace it with a single, what they call open primary, where all candidates and all voters would participate, regardless of what party they're a member of. And then in that open primary, the top four candidates receiving the most votes would advance to the general election, again, regardless of what party they're a member of. The second thing the initiative would do would be make changes to our general elections, and it would replace the normal general election that we're used to with what they call a ranked choice voting or an instant runoff system, where Idahoans would have the option to rank all four candidates on that ballot in their order of preference. So first, second, third, or fourth, if they would like, or if they would prefer, they can just pick their first choice. What would happen would be the candidate with the fewest number of first place votes would be eliminated, and then their votes would go to any second place, second choices on those ballots. That process would continue until there's just two candidates left, and the candidate with the most votes would win. Those are the changes that the initiative would make, but in order to even get it on the ballot, they have to qualify it by gathering signatures. They need about 63,000 signatures across the state of Idaho. That's about 6% of the registered voters. And then they also need signatures from 6% of registered voters in 18 different legislative districts in about half of the state's legislative districts. They got a late start. I'd been on the show, Gemma, a couple of months ago talking about some of the court challenges and the ballot language and the ballot titles. That's all been sorted out. And so about 2 months ago, they started collecting their signatures. I went out with them in Meridian on Saturday, spent about an hour and a half going door to door to see how it was going. And they're already up to 25,000 signatures statewide in a little less than 2 months. So they're nearly halfway to the statewide goal. They also have volunteer teams working in 29 or 30 different communities across the state, going door to door, gathering signatures, making appearances at public events. And so they're trying to make this statewide push. They have until May 1st to turn the signatures in. So they still have several more months. They're making a real good chunk at the statewide total. And I think the most difficult hurdle to clear is the 18 different legislative districts. But they do have a plan for that. Like I said, they've got the 29 or 30 different volunteer teams that are spreading out across the state. I actually got to kind of see it in action, and they have a mobile app that they use on their phone, and it has a list of all registered voters in a given neighborhood that comes up. And when the volunteers come door to door to gather signatures, it's going to tell them which registered voter lives there. And then they can mark whether the voter signed the petition or was not home or declined to sign the petition. That's one of the ways that they're able to stay organized and make sure that they're not asking the same people over and over and over again, say at the Boise Farmers Market, to sign the petition, because all the signatures need to be from different registered voters. So I had a story about it in the Idaho Capital Sun, but it was kind of interesting. And I enjoyed the opportunity that the folks from Idahoans for Open Primaries and the Mormon Women for Ethical Government, who's a new group who has joined the Coalition for the Open Primary. I thought it was cool that they let me spend about an hour and a half with them and kind of shadow them going through some neighborhoods in Meridian last weekend.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to see how this is going to move forward, Clark. So really appreciate the update on that. Sydney, I want to bring you into the conversation in keeping with the election theme. Tell us what's going on in CUNA, because their mayor is looking for, what, a third term?
Yeah, Joe Steer has been, or he's running for his third term. He's been in the public sphere for like decades, though. So it is interesting. He's got two challengers, one an entrepreneur and then one who's the president of the CUNA Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, okay. And we should note in your article that, as you mentioned, you know, it's his public service career because he's what, been a firefighter, a fire commissioner, a city council member, I mean, and the mayor. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with come election day.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Rachel, I want to bring you on. You were on the program a couple of weeks ago talking to us about the quagga mussel issue in the Snake River. Very quickly, before we really dive into this, can you explain to people why this is an issue that this was found in the river? So let's start right there.
Yeah, just to recap a bit, it's been almost a month since these quagga mussel larvae, or essentially tiny microscopic baby mussels, were found in the Snake River. It's a concern because the mussels are highly invasive, some of the most invasive creatures in the U.S. Another reason why it's a concern is that they can do a lot of damage to things that are important for Idaho and the Pacific Northwest, like irrigated agriculture systems, hydropower, essentially just pose a lot of challenges and, you know, financial costs to infrastructure. And once they're there, they're extremely hard to get rid of. And that is why it's kind of been an all hands on deck effort since they were identified to make sure they don't spread further.
Okay, so to make sure they don't spread any further, what was decided to be done about this?
Yeah, so for the past 2 weeks, actually ending today, there's been a treatment going on in a 6-mile stretch of the Snake River. It's from above Shoshone Falls, which that's like the big waterfall in Twin Falls, down through the center park area near the Perrine Bridge. And what's been happening is that Idaho State Department of Agriculture folks and contractors have been putting this chemical into the river. It's a copper-based chemical called Natrix, and it is what is called a molluscicide because it is designed to kill mussels and, you know, things like snails as well, because it's toxic to them. And that has been going on, like tens of thousands of gallons of that slowly have been put into three sites along the river to try to kill any mussels that are there, pretty much.
So you actually went out on the river yesterday. Tell us about this experience.
Yeah, earlier this week, I met up with some, there were some state officials and local officials meeting on top of Twin Falls Dam, which is kind of the upper stretch of the treatment area. The power plant is operated by Idaho Power, and it's one of the three sites where they're putting this chemical into the water. So on top of the dam, there were, you know, at least 20 of these giant buckets, some fill, some empty, of the blue copper-based chemical. And what they do is at the two sites where they have dams, they're actually using the power plants to introduce this chemical into the river. So they're using like the turbine system, for example, to mix the chemical with river water so that they can actually get the exact concentration that they need, which is one part per million out at the end. And so what results is this concentration that is what they're looking for to try to kill the mussels. So Governor Brad Little was there, ISDA folks were there, Fish and Game, just kind of seeing how it's all working. And as I said, that treatment, it wraps up today.
So Rachel, when you said, you know, I mean, this is the really the only treatment that seems to truly effectively kill these mussels. And as you said, they also, you know, kill snails. There are fish in the river as well. Are they impacted by this treatment?
Yeah, they're definitely impacted. You know, before it began, it was estimated that there would be significant fish mortality. The director of Idaho Fish and Game told me it's been thousands of fish so far. What's important to a lot of anglers in this area are sturgeon, because, you know, these are big, long fish, like 6 to 8 mm-hmm. feet long. And they can also be really old, like 10 to 15 years old. And so Fish and Game estimated that before this treatment began, there were about 50 sturgeon in this area. And so far, they have found 27 of them have died. All of the ones that have died have been hatchery raised, which they say is significant because it means that they have a chance of, you know, rejuvenating that population. But, you know, like I said, they're old fish, and so that will take some time. And, you know, it could be more of them as well, you know, beyond the 27, but also there are a lot of like smaller species of fish like carp and bass and whatnot that are also affected.
So, Rachel, how do they know when they've succeeded in killing all the mussels?
Yeah, I mean, after the treatment ends, ISDA will be doing more monitoring, the type of monitoring that helped them detect these mussels in the first place. You know, so if they don't find any mussel larvae after this, that's probably a good sign. If they find mussel larvae, but they're not alive or what you would call viable, like to grow into adults, that's probably also a good sign. But the problem is that we might not actually know for sure whether this worked until next year. And the reason for that is that when the temperatures get colder, it's thought that these mussels, they don't reproduce as much. So a female that is, you know, the size of a fingernail can release like a million eggs. And when that is not happening, it means that those larvae that would be floating everywhere, they're not out there. And so it's harder to know, are the mussels alive or dead? But the thing is, even if they're not reproducing through the winter, they could still be alive. And so then come spring, they could like wake up again. And all of a sudden we have a mussel problem again. And so it's something that we might not really know until the spring of next year.
Okay. Carly, we have some results for some statewide tests, the Idaho Reading Indicator Test, as well as, let me get the name here so I get it right, the ISAT test, the Idaho Standards Achievement Test. So can we start with the IRI, because it shows that we've got a lot of Idaho kids not reading it at grade level, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So about a third of the students who took the IRI last spring are not at grade level, and students in grades kindergarten through third took the test. So about 91,000 total took it, and about 31,000 are not at grade level, which is certainly alarming. And then if you look at the overall score, we've seen a decrease of about 3 percentage points from last spring. So State Department officials have pointed out that there is a new norming system that's been applied to the IRI this year, and they've attributed some of the decline to that. But nonetheless, the fact remains that tens of thousands of Idaho kids are not reading where they should, at the level they should be.
Is there any bright spot in this at all, Carly?
Well, the state is looking into implementing some new reading practices. Just this week, they had Emily Hanford come visit, and she's behind this award-winning podcast called Soul to Story, and it talks about the science of reading. And so I think state leaders are really looking at, hey, how have we been teaching reading, and how is there room for improvement? So our reporter Sadie Dittenberg went and covered that yesterday, and one of the takeaways from Hanford is that it's just really a complicated system, from school funding to teacher pay to curriculum selection to state policy to teacher prep programs. There's just a medley of things that go into teaching kids to read, as Sadie reported in her story. So, a lot of kids are struggling, but I do think leaders are looking at ways to help them. And I also did a story on some top 10s on the IRI. So places where schools and districts were really doing well. And we got some interesting info from that. So by score, meaning the percent of students who are reading at grade level, students were really doing well in urban areas like the Treasure Valley. And interestingly, we also did top 10 lists by growth, because the IRI is taken in the fall and in the spring. So we measure how students grow over the school year. And it was interesting because the top performers for growth were often in more rural areas and tended to have more geographic diversity. So there's some of the highlights and takeaways from the spring IRI scores.
Okay. And everyone, you can read really more in depth at Idaho Ed News for more information on that. So Carly, let's quickly switch to the Idaho Standards Achievement Test. So this shows that statewide students fared worse than they did last year on some of these benchmarks for measuring learning. But again, you wrote an article kind of breaking down some higher performers in these categories. So talk a little bit about this as well.
So on the ISAT, students are tested in three subject areas: English, language arts, and math and science. But we're just going to focus on ELA and math because science is a little bit newer. ELA and math have a history of scores going back for years. So on the English language arts portion, students' scores dropped by about 3 percentage points from last year, and they hit the lowest proficiency levels we've seen since 2017. On the math portion, the proficiency percentage fell by about 1 percentage point. But again, state officials have pointed out that the ISAT test was a little longer this year, and so they say some of the declines may be due to that. But in terms of top 10s for ISATs, we generated some lists to look at around the state where are traditional schools performing the best, and the same for non-traditional schools. So that would be like a charter or a magnet school. And again, we found that schools in West Ada and the Treasure Valley often top the list for both traditional and non-traditional schools. And I found that really interesting, and it just makes me ask, what does this say, if anything, about the quality of education in urban versus rural schools, especially since the legislature is tasked with giving Idaho kids equal education no matter where they live. There were some other interesting trends, like traditional public schools had a higher bar to get on the top 10 list for ISAT math and ELA than non-traditional schools. But non-traditional districts, which are called local education agencies, had a higher bar than traditional districts. So there's just so many ways to parse this data.
Yeah.
And the ultimate question we're wanting to get to is what's working and what's not, in efforts to ensure that Idaho's kids leave high school, college, and career ready and prepared to become informed contributing citizens.
Clark, you wrote a really interesting story recently about the Idaho GOP. Talk to us about this, because in your story, some Republican county leaders really say that nobody seems to care anymore about beating Democrats. They seem to be focused on beating each other. And my question would be, Clark, does that kind of put the party in a little bit of disarray a little bit?
Yeah, I think, Gemma, that's a good point. I think that there's a lot of division. And I just want to be clear that there's been division growing within the Republican Party for a long time now, but it really seems like it has picked up in the last year or so. And so I want to talk a little bit about some fights going on between county Republican committees and the state Republican Party. And it's kind of happening on both sides of the state. Here in Western Idaho, in Ada County, six officials from the Ada County Republican Central Committee resigned suddenly and en masse late last week. I think it was on Thursday evening. And they basically cited a list of five different concerns that they have with the Idaho Republican Party statewide leaders, including Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon. But the Ada County Republicans who resigned said that there's bullying tactics, that there's all these purity tests, that there's this waiting period for voters who switch from one political party and join the Republican Party. There's a waiting period now of up to 2 years before they can vote in a primary election. There's dues being assessed to the different counties. And so six different leaders from Ada County from the Republican Central Committee resigned suddenly last week, and they said that they cannot work with and they cannot lead while the Idaho Republican Party at the state level is operating this way. And that kind of took everybody by surprise, certainly. And it's a little unclear. We have 30 days to appoint new leaders in Ada County. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to work, but we're getting closer and closer to the 2024 election. But one thing they said is that in their resignation letter, they said that it seems like the Republican Party is more interested in fighting itself than fighting the Democrats at this point. And then over in Bingham County, there's a lawsuit where leaders of the Bingham County Republican Central Committee have sued the Idaho Republican Party and Chairwoman Dorothy Moon to block her from coming in and holding special elections to appoint new Republican leaders in Bingham County. There was an issue over the summer where their old chairman resigned, and in Bingham County, they held an election to elect new leaders, and Dorothy Moon voided that election and announced that she was going to come in and run her own election to appoint leaders there. They filed a suit and they asked a judge to block Chairwoman Moon from doing that until their appeal is heard. And so just this week on Tuesday, District Judge Darren Simpson issued an order blocking Chairwoman Moon from coming into Bingham County and holding her own elections until this appeal is heard. And I just thought it was interesting that as we're getting closer and closer to the 2024 election, we're seeing a lot more infighting, particularly between county leaders and state leaders of the Republican Party. I had been on Jim on Idaho Matters a couple of months ago and talked about the summer meeting with the Republican Party and kind of taking away the voice and the influence from some young Republican groups and some Republican women groups. That has led to some division, the new voter registration rules within the party, the waiting periods. All of this has led to division, the likes of which I have not really seen bubble up so publicly in the say 12 years that I've been covering the Idaho legislature and state government. But it's interesting, on both sides of the state, you've got county Republicans fighting with the state Republicans. And so one has a lawsuit, one, everybody just quit in Ada County. And so it has been kind of interesting, the fact that they're fighting amongst each other rather than looking ahead to different elections. And so it'll be interesting because next year in the Republican convention, there will be more leadership elections and another state party chair election. And so I'm curious as to whether this division will continue and whether it will flare up again next summer at the convention, or whether they will have moved past it and be focused on unifying the Republican Party for the 2024 election. But this division, this fighting just continues. And it doesn't show any signs of letting up from where I stand, Gemma.
Yeah, I agree with you, Clark. It is, I mean, we've seen infighting before, but nothing like this. So I think hold on while we watch all of this.
Yeah, stay tuned. I'm sure I'll be back.
Yeah, I'm sure you will be too. So, Sydney, tell us about this proposed event center that is apparently now getting the thumbs down from planning and zoning. So what's going on?
Yeah, so there is this company. It's called Hayden Beverage. They are a beverage distribution company. They have a property in Southeast Boise up on a bench. It's actually, I mean, it's got an amazing view. It overlooks Southeast Boise. You can see just so many things from there. And they've held a couple events in the past. And in order to do that, obviously had to get special permits because they're not an event center. And so they wanted to hold more events in the future. So they applied for a special zoning exemption so that they can have an event center on their property. People did not like this. lots of neighbors came to the Planning and Zoning Commission meeting this week and just testified against this event center. They talked about how they were affected by the events that had been thrown. I believe there were multiple concerts that they had thrown in the past that these residents who live in the neighborhood that's just right below Hayden Beverage, they said that the concerts shook their houses, that they could hear every lyric from inside their homes. The cops showed up to one person's house thinking that the sound was coming from their house, and they had to take them and show them, no, look, do you see what's happening up there? So just a lot of negative feelings toward this. The Planning and Zoning Commission event, and they decided to give a recommendation for denial based off of just the neighbors' complaints, but also because the Hayden Beverage didn't qualify for this zoning exemption. They said that there were other plots of land that were zoned near them to be able to have an event center. So if that's the case, then you don't qualify for a special exemption. There is a chance this could still be approved. I don't know how good of a chance that is, but they do have to take it before city council now and get the final decision from them.
Okay. So Carly, I know it was National Banned Book Week last week, but I do want to talk a little bit about this because you wrote an article where you spoke with Idaho's state librarian. I didn't realize we had a state librarian, so I learned something new. But also, she said that basically libraries and librarians are kind of over Banned Book Week. Can you talk a little bit about this and why they're feeling this way?
Yeah, so Banned Book Week is nationally held from October 1st through the 7th. And in years past, during this week, you would go to your local library or the school library, and a lot of times you would see displays for Banned Books Week, or a teacher might celebrate Banned Books Week in his or her classroom. But this year, there's been a big decline in that. And our state librarian, Stephanie Bailey White, she chalks it up to banned book fatigue. So she said librarians are just exhausted from contending with an unprecedented number of book challenges, facing intense scrutiny for what they stock on their shelves, and sometimes seeing titles pulled. She says that fatigue can lead to more self-censorship and just not wanting to fight the fight every day. And anecdotally, I've seen that as well. I've got some friends who are teachers who told me they didn't celebrate the week. My local library didn't have a display and they normally do. And I think it's partly because in years past, the display was meant to say, you know, can you believe these books were ever banned? But in today's political climate, that's becoming more of a daily reality for librarians. And it's taking a lot of their attention, you know, so they're kind of at a point where it's like, we'd love to be able to focus on other things, other library goals, like bringing together citizens who need community or closing the digital divide and things like that.
Well, and I thought it was interesting too in your article, Carly, because you kind of break down where the biggest challenges for banning books are coming from. And almost half are targeted at public libraries. I mean, you go all the way down the list, and I mean, college libraries, you know, other public institutions, it's 1%. So I found that to be really interesting too. So, you know, when you talk about fatigue, that's got to be a real thing with librarians having to not just deal with this, but I mean, really being the target sometimes of some vitriol.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think a lot of librarians had that in mind when they chose this job. So as you mentioned, 48% of public libraries nationally are seeing these complaints. And then 51% of the complaints are aimed at school libraries and schools. So they're bearing a lot of that burden as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Clark, can you talk to us about some really incredible news in regards to funding for our state parks? I mean, I kind of did a double take reading how big of a number we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is going to be a fun one to talk about, but there's a record influx of state and federal funding coming in for Idaho state parks. And we're talking about $140 million to transform all 30 of Idaho state parks. There's two different things going on. $45 million in federal funding through the American Rescue Plan Act that Congress passed and President Biden signed in 2021. And then that's being followed up with another $95 million in state funding through Senate Bill 1196 that the Idaho legislature passed and Governor Brad Little signed into law earlier this year on March 30th. And that particular chunk of money, Gemma, is coming from that record state budget surplus that we talked about a year and a half ago that the state had built up. So $140 million is going to be going into our state parks. And everybody who I talk to is pretty excited about this. And it's kind of a cool one because we had just talked about all the divisiveness in our government, right? And the divisiveness within the legislature and the political parties.
Yeah.
And people always ask me if the system is just broken. And if we get anything done at all, and this is a really good example of people working together to get something done. And so this is going to take years to roll out. We've talked about there's a design process, there's a bidding process well before, you know, shovels hit the dirt or anything like that. But what we're going to be talking about is over the next 10 years, 450 new campsites. We're talking about renovated restrooms, additional boat ramps, parking, trail improvements, electrical and water upgrades at all 30 state parks at all across the state. And there's three, I did an article for the Idaho Capital Sun where I kind of highlighted three projects where money is already starting to move. The state spent $2.5 million in that federal from that federal funding source, and they actually bought the Chalice Hot Springs and they're adding it to the land of the Yankee Fork State Park. And what this does is this ensures that public access to that hot springs will continue and it won't be developed into like a resort or a lodge or a commercial property. That's one of the projects. I also found out that there's money going to pave the 30-mile Ashton to Tetonia Trail, which is a scenic trail that opened in 2010 in eastern Idaho along the Teton Valley branch of the Union Pacific Railroad. They're going to pave it next year to improve accessibility. And throughout the whole length of that trail, there's just beautiful views of the Teton Mountain Range. And that's going to be under the umbrella of Harriman State Park. in Eastern Idaho, but it's the Ashton to Tetonia Trail. I'm super excited about that one, and I'm hoping to go out actually next year and ride the trail and do a story about it. But one other project with this money that I wanted to talk about, on June 1st, state officials celebrated the opening of the Bruno Dunes Observatory at Bruno Dunes State Park. And what they have is a system of telescopes that the public can use on Friday and Saturday evenings to check out the night skies for free. And there's actually talks to spend even more money at Bruno Dunes State Park and put in a planetarium. But I had an article in the Idaho Capital Sun about a week ago talking about the $140 million, talking about the different projects. But one other cool thing that I wanted to highlight is this really was a bipartisan effort. It was Democrats and Republicans and Governor Brad Little and the folks from Idaho Parks and Recreation working together to secure this funding. And Representative James Petsky, a Republican from Meridian, told me that he thinks this is really a once in a generation opportunity to help our state parks. And the state parks had been showing their age, and they've been experiencing record visitation since 2020. About 7.4 million people a year are visiting our state parks. And the budgets had been really, really lean coming out of the Great Recession. And so the state fell behind with maintenance and upkeep for years and years and years. And this was an opportunity to secure the largest funding bill ever for our state parks. And over the next several years, work on tackling that maintenance backlog and adding those new projects and improving accessibility. So hopefully people can check out that article and maybe get an idea for a state park or two that they would like to visit, because we are going to be seeing projects and improvements and maintenance for the next several years after our state parks had really, really experienced a lot of usage and really fell behind on their maintenance. And so this is a cool project to report on for sure, Gemma.
Yeah, it definitely is. I want to thank all of you so much for your time today. Big thank you to Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, our own Rachel Cohen with Boise State Public Radio News, and Sydney Kidd, reporter with BoiseDev.com. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.